Hello, on this week's program we remember Arnold Newman and explore his Philadelphia connections. The legendary photographer passed on Tuesday. We visit the Wagner Free Institute of Science in Philadelphia. It's just won a national award for innovation in education for doing things the old-fashioned way. Susan Lewis explores truth, memory, and the murkiness of memoir with artists from this year's First Person Arts Festival. Leslie Valdez has a review of the latest Pennsylvania Ballet production. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, Jason Pfeiffer visits the Wilma Theatre. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Arnold Newman died on Tuesday in New York. He was 88. He was best known as the pioneer of a style that would become known as environmental portraiture, where he would photograph his subjects in a highly composed setting that captured the essence of their life, their work, and, as some said, their soul. During his more than six-decade-long career, he photographed presidents from Truman to Clinton, but his most iconic pieces are those of artists and musicians, Picasso, Mondrian, Dalí, and Warhol, as well as Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein, while his most famous image is of Igor Stravinsky sitting at a piano, the lid of which looks strangely like a giant B-flat. Arnold Newman learned much of his early craft through his friendship with several students of Alexei Brodovich at what is now the University of the Arts, and began his career as a photographer working at the Litt Brothers Portrait Studio in Philadelphia. A number of his works are currently on display at the Woodmere Art Museum in Chestnut Hill as part of its Triennial of Contemporary Photography. This is the first time Newman has been exhibited in Philadelphia since 1945. I visited the Woodmere yesterday and spoke with Curator of Collections, Doug Pascal. Arnold Newman's work has become so much a part of our collective memory that we almost assume that this kind of photography always existed. What happened before Newman developed environmental portraiture?
Portraits in the past had largely been done in studios and still continue that way to this day in the hands of many artists. Arnold decided instead to go out and invite himself into the homes of these great people and see them in their own environments, the environments they created for themselves. It told you more about that person than you could learn in a studio sitting. You would see Eleanor Roosevelt in her cluttered office. You would see Aaron Copland sitting at a piano. These became the attributes of those figures. They were the things that told you who they were, what their accomplishments were. And that's what became known as environmental portraiture, and Arnold was considered the master of it, the real generator of this mode of portraiture that's become so influential. One thing I should say is that Arnold's choice of subjects was very careful. He didn't look for great people or famous people because they were famous. He looked at for those who had gotten there because they had actually accomplished something great. You wouldn't get a Paris Hilton type in an Arnold Newman photograph. You would get a Picasso. You would get an Eisenhower, a Kennedy. You would get a David Ben-Gurion. These were the people that he wanted. He was a real lion hunter, searching out those people who had made great contributions to society around the world in the 20th century.
This is actually the first show of his work in the city in 60 years.
He had his first one-man museum show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art in 1945, a show called Artists Look Like This, a series of artist portraits from the very beginning of his career. At the time of that show, he was 27 years old. The whole nation took notice of this. This was just completely unheard of, and magazines in New York were splashing large page spreads featuring this show. He started out at the top of the medium, basically. In terms of the disappearance of his work, I mean, you would see individual objects in shows here, Philadelphia, in the years intervening. But this opportunity with the Triennial was the first time we had to see a body of work. It's a small body, but it's a real retrospective look at a career that's absolutely fabulous.
He saw this as something of a triumphant return to Philadelphia, though, didn't he? This exhibition here at the Woodmere.
Yes, and that put a bit more onus on us because this is a show with a structure that a newcomer photographer in the show gets just as much wall space as the grand old master. And Arnold was incredibly generous in participating in the show as a result. I mean, most of your more famous photographers would go, well, no, I should get a lot more space. I'm much more accomplished. I have 60 years behind me. That person only has three. Arnold was this amazingly generous person, and he understood the structure of the triennial, and he wholly embraced it. He always loved working with young photographers. He was a teacher for many years at Cooper Union, and he saw this as a chance to not only play a part in this intergenerational dialogue between different photographers' works, but also because this is happening in Philadelphia, he took it very much to heart because this was where he first took up the camera.
Talk us through some of the works that are here. I think listeners will be surprised if they do come here to find just how many portraits they're already familiar with when they walk up to the wall. There's the very famous Stravinsky, there's the Warhol, Aaron Copland, Picasso, and many of these are images which we automatically have in our heads as the image of these particular people.
Well, that was what they were meant to be from the very beginning. When a magazine would send Arnold out to take a photograph of a great person, and most of his works were done on assignment, they were looking for a canonic shot. They were hiring Arnold because they knew he could produce them. And what he did was when he went into these people's environments and took their photographs, whether it showed the environment or not, I mean, the Picasso is a close-up and you don't see anything. So this idea of an environmental portraitist as the only thing he does is a misnomer. But whenever he would go in to photograph these people, he would try to convey as much as he could in a single photograph with this very tightly structured composition, a very strong attention to what was around him and what that person was exuding as a personality. And he would make sure that his photograph captured that. What's amazing is when you come to an array of them, as you see here, and you realize, oh my gosh, that one's by him, and that one, and that one, and that one. It's this recognition that here's 60 years of work that has created this entire body of imagery. And we only have a small selection of it here in this show. I mean, we could have done 100 more and still not really tapped the mother load. It's when you realize just how far that's gone that you realize how great the man was.
What's his legacy?
His work has had amazing impact. Half the photographers you'll talk to will tell you that the Stravinsky portrait is what turned them to photography in the first place. Anybody taking a portrait today cannot help but think of Arnold Newman's portraits. They might want to emulate them. They might want to do anything but that. But they are responding to these images because they are so powerful, they're so distinctive, they're so unique that you cannot avoid them.
Doug Paschal, curator of collections at the Woodmere Art Museum in Chestnut Hill, remembering Arnold Newman, who died earlier this week. The museum is currently exhibiting several of Newman's works, including iconic images of Igor Stravinsky and Pablo Picasso, as part of the second Woodmere Triennial of Contemporary Photography. It runs through June 26th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
It's been said that everyone has at least one book in them, and these days it's likely to be a memoir, as this literary form has pushed aside novels and moved onto bestseller lists and bookstore shelves. James Fry made big news last year with a memoir of his experience with addiction in A Million Little Pieces. He made even bigger news when it was discovered that he'd made up parts of the story. The reading public wants stories to be both well-crafted and true. Is it possible for memoir to be both? WRTI's Susan Lewis explores truth, memory, and the murkiness of memoir with writers from the First Person Arts Festival.
Once upon a time, telling the story of your life was something you might do if you were a famous sports figure or general, a politician or other celebrity. Then came the dawning of the age of confession, with people spilling sordid tales on Oprah and other talk shows, and the publication of books along the same lines, like Mary Carr's The Liars Club or James Fry's A Million Little Pieces. Nowadays, almost anything is a subject, any of us a potential author. Once the novel reigned supreme, yet today it seems that we are living in the age of the literary memoir.
I started out thinking I'd like to do something in theater, and then this memoir thing took me over.
Vicky Solot's fascination with the power of personal stories led her to found First Person Arts. Its fifth annual festival has been running this week in Philadelphia, with memoir readings, documentary screenings, and music and other forms of expression celebrating real people, real life, and real stories. Solot says that the mission of the organization is to use personal stories to bridge differences and bring people together.
hopefully the empathetic aspect of memoir and documentary will help us reach into other people's lives. It's hard to hear something really intimate about somebody, the real details and the real story that somebody carries around in them, and dismiss them.
The idea that a story is true is compelling, but what is the real story of someone's life? The theme of this year's First Person Arts Festival is Secrets and Lies, and the idea of truthfulness is a central focus and quandary in memoir. Because what exactly is a memoir? The word memoir is French with Latin roots meaning memory. Memory, on which memoir is based, is not the most reliable of sources, says Michael Finkel, author of True Story, Murder, Memoir, and Mea Culpa.
If 10 people that witnessed the same event a year ago, everyone would have a different version and none of them would be trying to lie. The moment something happens, you're ready, your mind is compartmentalizing it and shaping it, and so memory is flawed, of course.
The issues of what is fact, what is fiction, and the elusive nature of truth in storytelling have a particular resonance for Finkel. After being fired from the New York Times for creating a composite character in one of his articles, Finkel learned that a man accused of murdering his wife and children had assumed Finkel's identity. These stories formed the basis of his book, which he says became a meticulously researched memoir of his experience with a pathological liar, which made the idea of truth even more complex.
The book has three strands. One is my own story, my rise and subsequent fall at the New York Times. The second one is the life story of a man named Christian Longo who was accused of murdering his wife and three children and that trial. And then the third strand, actually the longest and possibly most intricate of the book, is my convoluted, confusing, and ultimately quite frightening relationship with this guy who took on my identity. The overarching theme of the book is how hard it is to find a true story.
Once it hits the bookstores, a memoir occupies an uneasy seat on the edge of the nonfiction shelves. Finkel says that a publishing world with only two broad categories of fiction and nonfiction is a problem.
It'd be like having two kinds of food, Chinese food and pizza. Where does pasta fit in? Where does sushi fit in? So memoir is in that fuzzy boundary between the two, often.
Carol Griffin agrees. A former tattoo artist, she's the author of Skin Deep, Tattoos, The Disappearing West, Very Bad Men, and My Deep Love for Them All. She says that her book was written as nonfiction, but she ran into problems when she realized that releases would be necessary from the real people she described.
The Very Bad Men part of the subtitle, not people who would sign a release readily if I could find them. So Harcourt said that I had to change identifying characteristics. If they were tall, you should make them short. But with tattoos, you can't do that. If you take a tattooed person and make them not tattooed when you write it, they're not the same person. And I would argue further that you can't just say, it was a butterfly, when really it was a squirrel. Or that's a bad tattoo example, but you can't alter things that are intrinsically part of that person and still call it truth.
Added to the problem of faulty memory and legal issues, you have the natural inclination of any good storyteller to, craft a story. Michael Finkel thinks that this is just human nature.
From the first caveman sitting around the first fire talking about his hunting of a saber-toothed tiger, there was exaggeration, there was cutting to the chase, there was lying going on. I think it's a very natural human thing to want to tell a story and to shape it.
And shaping a story isn't unique to memoir, or fiction, or literature considered art. Journalists may stick to the facts, but every journalist must pick and choose among all the facts he or she collects. Like this one I chose from my interview with Michael Finkel.
Even on the front page of the New York Times or the Philadelphia Inquirer or something that's not written in the first person, everything is filtered through a human and therefore colored, shaped, compressed. When you interview eight people, you pick one person to put in your article. There's shaping, there's coloring.
Frank McCourt's Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir, Angela's Ashes, recounted conversations with his mother when he was a small child. Did he remember these conversations word for word? Is memoir a form of fiction or nonfiction? Although memoir is typically listed as nonfiction, Carol Griffin says that her memoir is sold as both.
It's in different places in different bookstores. Some places it's marketed as literary fiction, and some places it's in memoir and personal storytelling.
The ambiguity in marketing reflects the nature of the art form, and maybe this is the key. The more we consider something art, the more creativity or artistic license we'll allow. First Person Arts President Vicky Solot says that this kind of expression is more complicated than a straight retelling of a set of facts.
It's different than, say, autobiography or a biopic in which somebody's story is retold. I mean, it's the telling of a story of your life and the reflecting on it and communicating the ways in which we have a shared experience or the way in which a unique experience can be extrapolated, the way any art does. It sheds light on humanity.
So what does this all mean? That truth doesn't matter, or that context matters more? The truth is, we don't want material facts changed, but what kinds of facts are material also depends upon the form of expression. We want names and dates and events to be accurate in scientific reports and journalism. But in memoir, truth may be something beyond the data, something more than a mere collection of facts.
Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis. The First Person Arts Festival continues through tomorrow in Philadelphia. Today's events include a noontime reading of Stephen Sorrentino's book Luncheonette, about taking over the family diner, and an evening program called Docs That Rock, featuring film segments and commentary by Alan Slutsky, the producer of Standing in the Shadows of Motown. Tomorrow, a morning garden tour by Joan Riley, director of Philadelphia Green, will be followed by a program examining Palestinian and Israeli perspectives in a noontime music performance by Intercultural Journeys. Excerpts from Julia Bash's film, Counterpoint, and readings by Jennifer Miller, author of Inheriting the Holy Land. Current received wisdom in the museum industry is that to engage young people, you need to go high-tech. Touch screens, interactive exhibits, and other high-tech bells and whistles are seen as the way to gain and maintain interest among kids, who daily spend hours on the internet, playing video games, and talking and text messaging on their cell phones. At the Wagner Free Institute of Science, interactive means having students directly explore the natural world, such as wetlands and nature reserves, then gain a greater understanding of what they've seen by close-up examination of artifacts and specimens. They've been teaching science at the Wagner for over 150 years through their unique collection of over 100,000 natural history specimens, and this venerable institution is recognized nationally for its contemporary interpretation of tried and tested education methods. Earlier this week, I visited the Wagner and spoke with children's educator Holly Clark. I first asked her how the Wagner has managed to buck current trends in museum education.
Recently, we went to the AAM conference and went to the Expo Center, and there's all these things there, and they're, you know, trying to get you to use their technology in your museum, and it wasn't appealing at all. I mean, as much as it was fun for me to sit and look at it and interact with it, it never even occurred to me that we would want to have that at the Wagner.
So give me an example of one of the programs. You go into, say, a class of fourth graders. How do you start the conversation?
With fourth graders, we do a whole year on wetland ecosystems. So because in our museum we have earth science and biological science specimens, we tend to structure the fall on the earth science and the spring on the life science. And we talk about the soils of the wetland and how they help filter water and provide the functions of the wetland, and we take them there. And in the spring, we focus on animal classification and relate it all back to the animals in those classifications that live in the wetland. And so we get this huge topic like wetland ecosystems, but get two other things like classification, percolation, and soil science by under this umbrella so that they can make those connections.
So they get a kind of a bigger overview of one subject rather than just, as you say, fragmented segments.
Absolutely.
Wagner Free Institute of Science children's educator Holly Clark. The Institute has just received the 2006 Excellence in Programming Award from the American Association of Museums for its GeoKids program. The award recognizes exemplary creativity and innovation in museum education programming. The Wagner is located at 1700 West Montgomery Avenue in Philadelphia. WRTI critic-at-large Leslie Valdez has just been to see one of the current season's most anticipated dance productions. Here's her review.
Dances by Matt Neenan and Chris Dunbois left an indelible impression during the last and best program of Pennsylvania Ballet's season. One was Neenan's world premiere set to music by Dmitri Shostakovich. It's called As It's Going and refers to an Anna Akhmatova poem. The poem says ghosts or memories of love return as love is ending. It was gloriously danced. As It's Going is austere and bittersweet, but also very witty. It has delightful partnerings and lifts. It continues the choreographer's interest in inventive ensemble. The seven sections include three string quartets, parts of a cello sonata, a piano trio, and the fantastic dances. Nothing about either the dancing or the playing by live quartet and piano was done to excess. Principal dancer Martha Chamberlain designed the costumes, whose shades of blue and brown perfectly summon its moods of joy, pain, and reverie. This is a beautiful work. Neenan's use of space is impressive, and his juxtaposition of informal gesture with ballet technique is not only fun to watch, it makes sense, and it holds our attention. 11-11 consists of six dances set to songs by Rufus Wainwright. The women wear filmy skirts and calypso tops, the guys white shirts and khaki pants. The movement appeals because it mingles the ordinary with the unexpected. If the music is undulating and quick, the dancing may be languorous and leaping. Though the suite is light-hearted, it's not superficial. "Nothing is as sexy as a line," said George Balanchine, one of the muses for D'Amboise's 1999 dance symposium. The others are Leonard Bernstein, whose Serenade for Strings is used here. The music itself is based on Plato's Symposium. The choreographer's other muse is the painter Mondrian, a visionary about line and shape and color. Symposium is the finest D'Amboise piece I've ever seen. The ensemble wears black, tank-style leotards, while the principals get the color. It's an athletic dance that calls to mind Stravinsky and Agon. There's an atypical trio for two men and a woman that Amy Aldridge, James Ady, and Meredith Rainey performed superbly. Bravo to the company for a program in which all the parts work together so well. It's a pleasure to see performers project such joy and discipline from their art. Dancing work made in their own time, by their own friends, could have a lot to do with this esprit de corps.
WRTI critic-at-large Leslie Valdez. Pennsylvania Ballet's season-ending production featuring 11-11, As It's Going, and Symposium has its final three performances this afternoon at 2, this evening at 8, and tomorrow afternoon at 2. The promotion of Broad Street in Philadelphia as the Avenue of the Arts hasn't been a long-term endeavor. It began only in 1993, with the backing of the city's then-mayor, Edward Randell. An independent non-profit organization was created to coordinate and oversee cultural development along the city's main north-south thoroughfare. Today, the several blocks of the avenue just south of City Hall are truly vibrant. There's the Academy of Music, the Kimmel Center, the Merriam Theater, the soon-to-be-opened new home for the Philadelphia Theatre Company, and the Wilma Theatre. In this week's Dip into the Culture File section at gophilla.com, Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer pays a visit to the Wilma and takes a look at one of the pillars of the Avenue of the Arts.
After the construction of the Forest Theatre at 11th and Walnut Streets was completed in 1928, Center City, Philadelphia had quite a dry spell in the opening of new theatres. Nearly 70 years later, in 1996, the Wilma Theater broke that silence when they opened their space on South Broad Street. People like the Wilma's longtime production stage manager, Pat Adams, are justly proud of this fact.
To be the first theater built from the ground up since then gives us another distinction. You can't think of or talk about the Avenue of the Arts without talking about the Wilma Theater.
The Wilma wasn't always on the Avenue of the Arts, however. Originally called the Wilma Project, the company was established in 1973 by two women as a feminist theater, a home for women theater artists. The group's name was derived from an essay by Virginia Woolf. She speculated that if Shakespeare had had a sister, say named Wilma, and she was as talented as he was, she would never have made it because she was a woman. The two founders of the Wilma Project moved on after a couple years, but the company stayed around. In 1979, Yuri and Blanka Ziska started working with the Wilma. As refugees from communist Czechoslovakia, who left the country after the government shut down their underground theater, the two took over the leadership of the Wilma in 1981. Co-artistic director Blanka Ziska explains that at that time, they considered changing the company's name.
But in some ways, there was some kind of an intimacy about that name that I liked. It's like, let's go to Wilma, you know, you have a kind of this intimate feeling about it. Of course, it's very odd, and people are asking us all the time about it. And everybody brings Flintstones into the conversation.
In 1981, the Wilma opened a small theater space on Sansom Street in Philadelphia, which is now known as the Adrian Theater. They stayed there about 15 years, and meanwhile developed a reputation as one of the most prominent theaters in the region. Part of the equation for the Wilma's success seems to be the Ziska's preference for edgy, innovative, and provocative plays. Co-artistic director Blanka Ziska.
Theater for me is not an escape. You know, it's really kind of a wrestling match. It's wanting to know. It's wanting to know who we are and why we behave certain ways. And I love authors that can do it and can ask those questions in a very original, witty, daring way.
The types of plays chosen for the Wilma stage are also exciting for the other people involved with the company, who've elsewhere experienced the reality that many theaters, for one reason or another, gravitate towards lighter and safer works. Stage manager Pat Adams.
It's about the art. The theater that we do here is the theater that I went to school for. It's the theater that I learned about in school. The plays that we do here, everybody doesn't like them, quote unquote, but everybody talks about them. And I learned that theater always created conversation, and that's what we do.
As the Wilma secured its place in the Philadelphia arts scene in the early 1980s, the company decided to pursue building a new home in 1986. It took nearly a decade before the dream was realized, but the patience paid off. The leadership of the Wilma had plenty of time to think about and craft the theater space they wanted. The new building's surprisingly intimate 300-seat auditorium with no center aisle boasts one of the largest stages in the area, 42 feet in width and 48 feet deep, deeper than most Broadway houses. As one walks into the auditorium, one of the most striking features are the walls. They're covered with dark-stained oriented strand board, or OSB board. The inexpensive panels are made of compressed wood chips. But the use of the Wilma is not merely about keeping costs down. Production manager Patrick Heidenberg says the boards serve to liven the acoustics of the room.
And that was a very important mandate from both Blanca and Yuri from the beginning, that spoken word would not need to be mic'd in the space, and we never mic any of our dramas. We'll mic a musical, perhaps, but the acoustics in this room are fantastic, and that's all part of it. The building was built to our specifications. This was designed to build as a theater. This isn't a renovated parking garage or warehouse or church or something. This was built for us. The artistic directors knew what they wanted, and they got it, which was an intimate space that could still hold 300 people.
Heidenberg also points out that the stage wasn't just designed for traditional theater, but also dance. This makes it a venue of choice for events like Dance Boom, an annual Philadelphia dance festival.
Dance looks so good in this space. The floor was specifically built so that they can dance on it with a certain amount of reflectivity on the floor, and it's successful in that way.
One of the drawbacks of the Wilma facility is something that most audience members will never see, the wing space on either side of the stage. Huge concrete columns run through the center of the small offstage area, which makes storing and moving show scenery difficult. The pillars are there to support an overhead parking garage and a future 10-story office building to be built above the theater. After a decade with the company, Pat Adams explains she's learned to take such obstacles in stride.
Heaven forbid we let anybody think that this is just the great wonderland and everything is perfect. It's as it is with anything. There are problems, but they are our problems that we work around. And I think we do a pretty decent job of making it all work. Being here for 10 years, you learn a couple of things about the quirkiness of the building and the challenges that she brings for every production.
Alongside over 37 cultural organizations and venues on the Avenue of the Arts, the Wilma Theater is at Broad and Spruce Streets in Philadelphia.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. More information on the Wilma Theater can be found at the Culture File section of gophila.com. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Emily Sharamy, Megan Smedley, Helke Rass-Palmier, and Beth Case. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.